But right now, let's go to Australia, where misery loves company. When Australian Guardian columnist Bridie Jabour wrote about a sense of malaise felt by 31-year-old millennials, she found kindred spirits all over the world. She suggests that the malaise comes from a realisation that life may not be going the way it's supposed to. Throw in a pandemic, and for her, a near-fatal car accident with her family, and Bridie has learnt some harsh lessons about expectations and gratitude. She shares her roadmap for navigating a path away from discontent in her book, which is called Trivial Grievances, on the contradictions, myths and misery of your 30s by Bridie Jabour. She joins me now. Hello there.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Nice to talk to you. I was just taking a bit of a punt on your surname, Jabour. Have I got that right?
You nailed it. Yeah, great. I thought that you must have looked it up when I heard you say it.
Welcome to New Zealand Radio. Nice to talk to you. Why do you think that first article of yours hit such a nerve?
Well, I think that there is, you know, you never want to generalize too much. And I think that there's generalizations in particular about generations that I find quite lame and annoying. So when I started noticing this kind of misery and this, well, basically I ended up figuring out it was an existential crisis that so many were having. When enough people said to me and agreed with me and told me about their misery, and I wrote that article, I really was not expecting any kind of reaction. That article was written in summer, in the week between Christmas and New Year, you know, when you just run stuff about life, you know, things that aren't tied to the news cycle, like easier summer reads.
Yeah.
So I certainly wasn't expecting any kind of reaction. And when and then when I woke up the next morning, more than 600,000 clicks around the world, and emails and interview requests from New York, from England, emails from India, parts of South America and Queensland here. And there were some from New Zealand as well, actually. And so why do I think that I struck that nerve? I still haven't quite figured it out, you know, but I guess I just noticed something in common in the people hitting their early 30s around me. And then when I took a punt and put something out into the world, wondering if it was a thing, well, it was very, very much confirmed that I'd struck a chord, but I was not prepared at all for the response that it got.
Yeah. But part of the disconnect, I wonder, is for older people, is why is there so much misery on the inside for people in this age group when from the outside they seem to have it pretty good?
Yeah, well, I think that was the interesting thing that I noticed about people. It didn't really matter if they had started a new job, if they had a great career, if they were unemployed, if they had kids, if they were married, if they were single. It was right across the board this kind of existential crisis was happening. And I think there were a few reasons for it. And I also think that it is not unique to millennials. This is a really good old-fashioned existential crisis that has definitely happened to people before now and happens at different ages and probably will strike again for anyone who's experienced it in their early 30s. But I think the phenomenon is definitely something collectively happening to people in their early 30s that didn't necessarily happen at this age previously. And I think, you know, there are lots of positives in our lives and social changes that have been amazing and that are going well, but it's also a really difficult time to be growing up. I think a lot of people in general in their 30s aren't hitting the same markers of adulthood that their parents had made look really easier and made look easy. You know, I think it's a lot more difficult to get a full-time long-term job where we're well and truly in the gig economy now, where most people have a few different jobs, including myself, and I've got it good and still I have a few different jobs. It's obviously harder to buy property. Most of our parents in general had a family home by this age, and I know that you guys in New Zealand have exactly the same issues that we have here in Sydney, but it's also basically, you know, it's New York, London, it's basically any developed country is having these issues with property. And when people, I think that can be written off as like the millennial whinge or millennials being entitled, oh, boo-hoo, they can't have a four-bedroom house. I don't think that's the issue, though. When people are talking about wanting to own property, it's not to be rich or a wealth thing. Of course, it is that for some people. People want a home. You know, most rental rights in most developed countries or Western countries aren't that great, and you want to be able to settle down somewhere where you're not going to be kicked out at the whim of someone else because they want to sell it or they think there's a better way to make money with it. You want to even be able to do simple things like put a like freaking nail on the wall and hang up a picture. You know, it's frustrating not being able to have a proper home. And I think that's why there's so much angst around that in particular. So that's one of the issues. And there's also, you know, more single people in the world that there ever has been and this point in history and delayed baby making. So I think all those things pile on top of each other and make people feel like their life isn't turning out the way or following this simple trajectory that they thought it would follow.
As an insight to the mindset, you say that you used to lie in bed at night and tick off what you'd achieved that day. Why did you feel compelled to do that?
Yeah, I wrote about that in an essay about feeling the need to achieve and to feel productive. And I think that that is something that is very much of our current moment in time and our current moment in history where we all feel that we should be striving and we're told that we should be striving and we're told that we should be achieving. So when I did that mental checklist, I still do it sometimes. And there can be like big things on that checklist, like, you know, write 2,000 words of a book or run 5 kilometers. Not that I've been able to run in a long time really, actually, but it used to be on the list. Yeah. And it could even be like the littlest things, like, you know, clean the desk or book in a doctor's appointment for vaccinations or whatever. And I just think that that comes, people, when they want to achieve and they want to be productive, I think that that comes from a deep longing for your life to mean something and to be trying to impose some kind of structure on it or some kind of narrative on it. And that's a very natural impulse. And I think that the way that it manifests for a lot of people at the moment is, you know, achieving well at work or looking like you're achieving well in the world and ticking things off your to-do list. It's very hard to snap out of.
You have a theory about millennials, and it's represented by the stories of a couple of celebrities that people will probably know, Meghan Markle and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's the representative, the US House of Representatives. What can we learn from them about the way millennials tend to think?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if this is completely unique to millennials or this is something that everyone thinks at different points in their life, because there's certainly older people who have told me they think this way. I think that people feel like they are, at different points, the protagonist of reality, or that they are a significant and special person and they are interesting and that soon the world is going to notice or something really big is going to happen for them and people are going to sit up and pay attention and see them and see them clearly and perceive them clearly. And I think that secretly, deep down, a lot of people are waiting for that moment. So, and I think Meghan Markle and Alexandria, you know, huge things happen for them. Like Alexandria became a member of Congress in her 20s and has become globally famous. And Meghan Markle, well, we know, you know, we all know her story. And I think that when they had their big moments come and they became that famous and, you know, did those big achievements, I think that they were thinking deep down, yeah, well, of course this has happened because I was born special and I am interesting and I do deserve this attention.
It explains why they look so ready for it when they finally emerge on the world stage, right?
Yeah,
like they were born
to
do it.
So natural. Yeah, and so natural and born to do it because they're thinking, yeah, finally people are seeing that I am unique. I am special. I think that that's a fine way to think, and I think it is something people have deep down. And then you get to your 30s and you realize, most of us, you know, I'm never going to be a famous rock star. I've never been able to play an instrument or hold a tune, but I don't know, in your early 20s, the world is full of endless possibilities, isn't it? Maybe I could have been when you're in your early 20s, I think you think anything could happen. And that's just a way to illustrate that feeling. You think anything could happen and you get to your 30s and you realize, well, a lot of those things aren't going to happen and this is how your life looks and is this how you want it to look and are you happy with it?
I'm speaking to Bridie Jabour, whose book is called Trivial Grievances on the Contradictions, Myths and Misery of Your 30s. And you write, Bridie, that there are few simple pleasures left that we don't feel some kind of need to excel at. Can we blame social media for that in part?
Definitely in part, yes. I think it's part of our culture as well in general and our striving and hustling culture, but social media has certainly exacerbated it, you know, and the examples I have of that, lots of people don't just have hobbies anymore. You've got to make them your side hustles or figure out a way to monetize it. And you don't simply just read a book or read a few books anymore. You take photos of them and post the stack on Instagram and show how many books you've read. And, you know, cooking now is, for many people, is not just a utilitarian task that we've all got to do every day to feed ourselves, but, you know, there's Ottolinghi recipes to recreate and our creations to post on social media so that everyone can see how good we are at this and how well we're doing. And those are the two prime examples I use to show that mindset that people have, where sometimes you just can't simply be, or can't just do things for pleasure's sake because you want to. There has to be meaning in it beyond that. I think it's something a lot of people get sucked into.
Yeah. It's so hard to assess what life was like for different generations. Nostalgia can blur things. But you write, I wonder if this is one genuine difference between generations, you write that lots of us don't have religion or lifelong communities to feel tethered to anymore. We have moved more to being defined by what we have achieved. Is there something in that that will help us understand the condition of the 31-year-old living in 2021?
Yeah, and I think, you know, people are really quick to blame social media for unhappiness, modern unhappiness and modern malaise. I don't think it is social media's fault. I think that what's happened is we've been siloed off from each other more and more and become much more individual and have fewer things to gather around as a community. An obvious example of that is religion. You know, it wasn't so long ago that most people you knew went to church on a Sunday, so you'd see your neighbors and friends there and then maybe you would have lunch after, but there was a set thing each week, a set place to go and gather and congregate. And we're losing those things more and more. There's not that much stuff anymore, that many things that most of the community, most of your neighborhood would be involved in, or where you would see your neighbors. And I think that that is a real reason for growing unhappiness, is people's growing isolation from each other. Because to be content and, you know, to live a meaningful life, I think a big, big part of that is being part of a community and surrounded by people that you love and who love you.
But it would be too easy just to blame the smartphone, right? You don't go in for that.
No, it's not the smartphone. Like, it's not smartphone's fault that we're stepping away from religion. I think it's quite a natural thing to evolve away from religion. But I think a big part of it is our working lives and the pressure on all of us to work and to work longer and harder. And we've got way less of a demarcation between, you know, your work life and your leisure life. Those two things have become so blended. And I blame that much more than I do the smartphone. And, you know, the internet and everything has been part of us being able to take our work home. But we've also part of a culture, and being part of a culture, it's expected of us to work hard. There's moral value seen in working hard, and you're seen as deficient or something wrong with you if you don't work hard or you don't want to work hard. And I think that that is a way bigger issue and something that's isolating people much more than any smartphone or social media.
And so to your story, which you're really honest about in the book and in your writing, you said that you were miserable. You were asking yourself, is this my life? Despite the fact you had a dream job and a stable relationship and two healthy kids, and that changed, one, when your son had a seizure, and then more recently when you had a near-fatal car accident. How did that change your thinking?
I got very big reminders about the vital stuff of life. And I think it's fine to look around your life. Like, I wasn't miserable because of my kids or my relationship or my job. It was just something. It was something inside me thinking, is this it? Is this what the meaning of my life is? Or is this how my life looks? And even when it looks perfectly fine, you know, you're still thinking about, you still get to a point where you think of all those paths that you didn't take and that got closed off to you. But I was brought back to the vital stuff of life pretty brutally twice. The first time when my 14-month-old had a seizure in front of me out of the blue, and I thought that he was dying. And truly, truly thought that in the moment when I was on the phone to 000, and he ended up being fine. But that kind of, I think once you felt that terror, certainly for me, I was changed. I was a changed person, a changed parent. I'd never been the same or as carefree as I was before that moment. Mm-hmm. And changed sometimes in good ways as well. Like, I'm not a traumatized person, but it certainly shakes you up. And then the second thing that happened that really brought me back to what's important was a few months ago, we were, my two sons and my husband and I were traveling on a highway and we got hit by a semi-trailer from behind and our car rolled three times. And the triple O call was car hit by truck in 100 zone, rolled three times. When you get a call like that, they dispatch the helicopter because of what they were expecting to see at the scene. And we all walked away completely fine and just incredible. The doctors, people couldn't believe it. Paramedics couldn't believe it. Doctors can't believe it. Nurses can't believe it. We had people coming, like nurses and doctors coming and visiting our hospital rooms because we still had to go for observation. Just completely stunned to hear that we had all walked away. Mm. We got told so many times, we never see this. We never see this. When you have a moment like that, it certainly brings into sharp relief what is important in life and what is not.
Yeah. This is a bit of a random question, but any chance the global pandemic, which after all, no other generation living memory has had to deal with, any chance it will help put priorities into perspective?
I think so. I think, and obviously it's not just people in their 30s who are experiencing the pandemic and who have their lives changed by it. Like, you know, it's impacting people of different ages in so many ways and very profoundly. But I'm not sure if you've noticed this, but I know so many people who have decided to divorce in the past year. I know so many people who are suddenly leaving the city and moving to the country or moving different places. And I know lots of people who have quit their jobs. And I really think it has been brought on by the pandemic. And these people that I know in Australia and also in England, where I know a lot of people have family, and in New York, like they're all in all different places. And it's been pretty interesting to watch. And I think it is because they're having, you know, the pandemic is bringing them back to the vital stuff of life and making them consider, is this the life I want to have? Do I want to work this hard? Do I want to be with this person? Do I want to live in this place? Well, life isn't really very long, really, is it? And I think that it definitely has been the impetus for people to make some big changes. And I think it's going to bear out in the data and research in the next few years as well.
You said that being in lockdown reminded you of being pregnant with your first child. What was the analogy there?
It really did, because I felt so restricted. And I felt like everything fun in my life had been taken away from me. But being in lockdown, it really was like pregnancy. It's like there's a surrender you have to make and you have to accept limitations and restrictions on yourself that you have never had to deal with before. And you also have to accept how much in life is actually beyond your control. So when you're pregnant, well, in my experience of pregnancy, you know, I'm not very mobile, couldn't move in the way that I'd been used to moving for 29 years. Couldn't go where I wanted, when I wanted, because I was slowed down a lot and quite sick. Obviously couldn't drink what I wanted to drink, couldn't exactly eat everything I wanted to eat. And, you know, all these simple decisions were taken away from me and I really resented it and struggled with it in a really, like, weirdly psychological way that I wasn't expecting. And then I felt the same thing in lockdown. You know, everything that I took pleasure of in life was kind of taken away from me and all of a sudden your life changes so suddenly and you realize, wow, I don't actually have that much control over things, do I? Like, things can happen to me and my body can betray me. Like my body can betray me in ways I didn't realize. Well, you know, so can the world. So, and I think that's actually why I handled the first lockdown pretty well. I'm not handling this lockdown very well, though, to be honest.
Any advice or anything you've learned that might help people who are feeling a little lost or rudderless?
I think the main thing that I learned in this book that has stuck with me is that being happy all of the time is a very inappropriate and unnatural thing. Nobody should be happy all the time because you don't change your life when you're happy all the time. You don't decide to do things differently. So if you didn't experience periods of unhappiness, you wouldn't change or evolve as a person and you would just live the exact same life pretty much every day. So even when things are tough, usually what's going to come out of that is something positive. It's not always, you're not always going to be unhappy. There is going to be a time again when you're happy and it is the impetus for change. And so I think that's always a really good thing to remember. And also it has helped me remember, you know, when things are going really well and I'm really happy, well, it's not always going to be like this. I'm going to have some unhappy times ahead of me. But equally, when things are tough, it's not always going to be like that either. You know, it's going to change. And I think that's a good thing to keep in mind and a good perspective to have.
It's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Bridie Jabour is columnist for The Guardian. Her book is called Trivial Grievances on the Contradictions, Myths and Misery of Your 30s.